and consider becoming a BAI buddy. For as little as $10 a month, you can help the station and make a recurring donation on behalf of this program. As a BAI buddy, you receive a WBI membership card, as well as very nice discounts at area museums and various local facilities, and selected WBI-supported events. And I'll donate a free CD, no charge to the station. It's a safe, secure, and easy way for you to support this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station, WBAI.org. Thank you for your support.
Thank you for your support. I remember when I went into the studios up there on the Upper West Side in Gary Null's studio to record that with him a couple of years ago, actually, when Hurricane Superstorm, that is Sandy, came through. 6 o'clock here in New York City. Stay tuned for The Morning Show. News, better hang loose at 2 minutes past the hour of 6 o'clock on a Friday morning, the 20th day of November 2015. Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and I'm in studio this Friday morning with my Tuesday partner, Pam Brown. Good morning, Pam. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I am fine. I am fine
indeed. It's a little weird being here on a different day.
Yep.
It feels different.
A little bit different today. Mario Murillo, as I've said last week, he's away working on some projects, so he will be out for a few weeks, but there will be some guest hosts here with me on Friday, and then some days I'll be doing it by myself throughout the rest of the year. But Pam, it's great to have you in the studio with me this morning.
And it's great to be here, as always, Michael.
It is, what is it, about 57 degrees?
Yeah.
What is it looking like?
Well, when I left, it was 59. Mm-hmm. It says 56, actually, now. So it's going down. It's actually not going to go up throughout the day today. Okay. It's going to start to go down. The low is going to be 40,
wow.
But it's still going to be about 48 by 9 p.m.
Okay.
I hope people aren't deceived by the warmth this morning, because it is going to become a fall day before you know it.
It's going to dip down. So, Pam, what do we have on the program this morning?
Well, as you do on Friday mornings, we have a film review at 6:30, and then we're going to be able to play a recording that we did with a French delegation who was here in town to advocate for Mumia Abu-Jamal. They actually were here from France to come and say that he should have medical treatment while he's in prison, which is, this happened, of course, before, the,
before
the attack. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then in the 7 o'clock hour, we are going to hear from some students at Princeton about their takeover of the president's office around this Woodrow Wilson issue. Then we're going to go to the New York African Diaspora Film Festival for some information on that. And we're going to get in a play that that I actually had the fortune to see last night, which is called Dead and Breathing, and talk a little bit about that production at the National Black Theater up in Harlem. And then I think you do this regularly on Fridays at this time.
I'm trying to instill
Incidents
it.
In the Life of a Slave Girl.
All right.
Michael's been playing that for listeners daily for a while now, right?
Yeah, about a little over a week. And I got some of the women from WBAI when we were up at WHCR to start participating, and I said, you know, I wanted to try to do this, and it's a really a powerful book, the narrative of the slave experience by black women. This particular young woman, Linda Brent, recounted her experience during the 1800s. So we're looking forward to that. That's going to wrap up the show. But first things first, as always, we have news with Linda Perry. Coming right up on the morning show.
Good morning. Here's some of the news for Friday morning, November 20th, 2015. Today is the one-year anniversary of the death of 28-year-old Akai Gurley. He was killed by NYPD officer Peter Liang in a stairwell at the Pink Houses in East New York. This while Liang and his partner, NYPD officer Sean Landau, patrolled the NYCHA building. Liang was indicted by a Brooklyn grand jury on multiple charges, including second-degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. Liang's partner received immunity in exchange for testifying against Officer Liang. The family continues to seek justice for Akai Gurley. Today, the committee, along with Gurley's mom, Sylvia Palmer, and Kimberly Ballinger, the mom of Gurley's daughter, will meet with Brooklyn DA Ken Thompson and Assistant DA Mark Fleidner about the case. Shavon Ford is a member of the Justice for Akai Gurley Family Committee.
What we've been doing over this past year is that we were able to get, and we meaning the family support committee, we were able to get the officer indicted in February of this year. And now we actually, this fall, we got the case to go to trial, and which is going to be set to take place at early next year.
Ford says the family and the Gurley Justice Committee are on a road to receiving justice.
What we've been doing over this past year is that we were able to get, and we meaning the family support committee, we were able to get the officer indicted in February of this year. And now we actually, this fall, we got the case to go to trial, and which is going to be set to take place at early next year.
The trial for NYPD officer Peter Liang in the killing of Akai Gurley will begin in January of 2016. This evening, beginning at 6:30, the family will hold a rally to honor Akai Gurley.
It's a rally to show the community that we're still here. We're still concerned about what happened to Akai Gurley a year ago. And we're also here with taking a mother to the site so that she can visit where her son was actually killed a year ago. Akai's mom has never set foot into the Pink Houses where he tragically lost his life. And we're going to be having her there with other members of his family that are going for the first time. And it's going to be a very sobering moment because, you know, a year later we have made strides, and we just want the community to know that we are grateful for their support in the community, meaning the police brutality movement as a whole, as well as the residents in the Pink Houses. We want them to know that, you know, we're still here. We're fighting for justice not only for Akai, but for the larger East New York, Brooklyn community as well.
That's 6:30 for the rally at the Lewis Pink Houses, 724 Linden Boulevard in Brooklyn, New York. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Thank you. Thank you.
Butterfly, Butterfly by Rad, R-A-D, period. That's Rose and DiMalanta on WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Michael G. Haskins and Pam Brown are your hosts this Friday morning, the 20th day of November 2015. What is it? It's 48 degrees.
50 degrees.
Sorry, going
58
down.
58 degrees.
58 degrees, excuse me.
It'll be 48 me. By 9.
By 9 o'clock. It'll be 50 by 9.
I
so
know,
get that
it's
now.
Hard to think that it's almost 60 degrees
right it's
right
almost
now.
60 degrees now, it's, but it's going down. It's heading in the opposite direction.
And by the way, Thanksgiving is next week.
It is. It is. I said, no, it's 2 weeks from now. Early in the week. She said, what are you talking about? It's next week. It is next week. And I will not be here on Thursday or Friday. There will be some special programming, some special hosts, some guest hosts. I'm not sure what it'll be, but I'm going to be with my kids, one of them anyway. And I'm going to be enjoying myself, and I hope that you, Pam, are going to be doing that. And I certainly hope that all of our listeners will be tuned in. I'm going to be listening through WBAI.org. I might not get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, get up at 6 o'clock.
That's sleeping late for you.
It's very late. You know, when I take time off, it takes actually 3 days to acclimate myself to sleeping late.
Right.
That's not even true. If I'm out of the city, then I can really do it. But just taking a day off here or there and say,
right.
Okay, well, I still get up at 4 o'clock
four.
At the very least.
Yeah.
But, if I leave the city and I'm in a closed environment, a dark environment, a quiet environment, then I'm all right and I can get some sleep.
You know what you need? You need those eye coverings.
Yeah.
I know that sounds a little funny, but you get these, they're just like almost masks that you put over your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They come in different varieties. If you get a decent one that's kind of thick, it's actually amazing how much that helps with sleep in the city because there's so much light pollution.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many noises, things like that. Just having that dark is amazing. It really helps your sleep.
You know, we don't have a television in our bedroom, and I'm so glad that the we decided together not to put a television in the bedroom because the bedroom is for two things. And one of them is sleep, and the other one is the other one. But the sleep, that's what you should be doing in the bedroom. Okay, you could read sometimes. But television, don't have a television. Anyway, good morning again, Pam. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great
this morning.
To see
it's
you
second
again
time
this week.
It's great. Great.
Yeah, there's so much happening in the world right now.
Yeah.
Last night, my husband Christopher and I drove into the city to see this play that we're going to be talking about in the 7 o'clock hour.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, it was pouring rain.
Oh, yeah, sure.
We were driving up to Harlem from Brooklyn, and the traffic was incredible. I've never seen, there was so much traffic.
Really?
There was flooding, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also a ton of cars. And finally, we realized together that probably a lot of people were driving into the city because of all of the fear around, terrorist, so-called terrorist attacks hitting New York City.
Mm.
And I'm betting that a
Not
lot of people decided, forget about the train, right?
Wow.
Because obviously if anything were to happen here. Apparently there was a big scare, or there's an ongoing scare. I heard about this. I don't know if it's true, but I did hear that there was an ISIS video featuring Times Square.
Yes.
So I think that probably people are thinking to themselves already, how can I stay out of Manhattan? Or if I have to go in, how can I be in my own car, not go into public transportation or public places? And I see that the House actually approved this tougher refugee screening provision. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I did.
But they voted to dramatically tighten. I mean, I don't really quite understand it. Maybe you can fill me in. But they're saying that the director of the FBI and the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and the director of National Intelligence will have to confirm that each applicant from Syria and Iraq poses no threat. I mean, what are the chances that individuals are going to put their name?
I mean, well, I don't understand this. I don't understand.
We've only even taken 2,000 Syrian refugees.
We talked about this yesterday. That's to say, Hugh Hamilton was on, and he had a commentary outlining some of the really rigorous processes that individuals have to go through when they're in refugee status. You know, you can't just say, well, I'm fleeing persecution. You really have to prove that. And it's a process that's gone through in another country. It's not gone through here. Mm. You're not somewhere mm-hmm. here going through that process. Mm-hmm. You're in another country. So I do understand what the fear is, given what's going on, what has happened in France over this past year.
Sure.
Understand that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's a federal policy and not a state policy. So, you know, there are legal ramifications there. But 47 Democrats crossed over or something
exactly.
like that. And I want to know
nearly
who they
50
are.
Democrats yeah, voted. Yeah. You know, Michael, I have to say that this is so sad, because the idea that we can block people from coming to the United States, you know, bring me your poor, bring, you know, all of
we
the, our story.
We don't care about anything but our safety. Now, in saying that, you and I know, as because I know somebody's screaming at the radio right now talking
yeah.
about, listen, I love my family and my friends, and I don't want anything to happen to them.
Right.
That's not the point.
No.
That's not the point at all. But mm-hmm. we tend to act like, or at least this is what I'm hearing, that we have to protect the American homeland and American citizens. Yes, that's true. But I'm hearing also on the other side, people are saying that's not what we're about as Americans. And I would say, the president said this, hold on there.
Right.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, that's what we say. We like to say and like to think that we're so great and welcoming. But look back at the history
yeah.
of this country. It tells you something
Michael,
totally different.
Let's not forget that a lot of these crazy Republicans wouldn't even consider Barack Obama an American.
That is true.
Okay.
That is true.
So when we're talking about this, we're not just talking about, you know, blocking people in a particular kind of way out of simple fear, but who those people are, how we understand them, how are people going to live here in this country? But the thing that strikes me as so off about this is we've probably had too much success so far in using surveillance to ensure our safety,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
I don't really think that if somebody really wants to get into this country to, you know, blow something up, whatever it mm-hmm. is, right? They're going to be able to get into this country.
Yep.
You're not going to prevent this, or maybe they're just even from this country. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we have plenty of our mm-hmm. own homegrown folks, okay, out there. So it's just the wrong methodology. We can't apply this kind of method to this problem. And it's sort of like saying, wow, we really don't want to take a look in the mirror and think about how do we need to change?
Mm-mm.
How do we need
no.
to really change
no. No.
in order to live in this world? And I can only personally see negative consequences of this, because I don't believe that for a second. I really don't believe
yeah.
for a second that we can protect ourselves from ISIS in this way. And we'll see when we listen to the French delegation.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we'll have time to talk about that.
Mm.
But I do think that there is an ideological battle, but we could change our ideology somewhat and still maintain some of the things that we really think are good about the United States and about, you know, our way of life per se, but also open up the possibility that we haven't been interacting with the rest of the world
in
a way that produces anything other than anger or, well, anger, let's say.
Yeah.
And leave it at that.
And at some point in the future, and we hope that it's not the too distant future, we'll be able to talk to some of you about that, because that would be fantastic.
Right. And I don't know. I really am interested to do that. I think it's going to happen soon that we're going to have the phones again. But by the way, I mean, breaking news is that 170 hostages were seized in an attack in a hotel in Mali. Apparently, many of them were French. So I don't know any more details than that, but it doesn't look like the world is going to be safe due to surveillance.
Yeah, that's really crazy. And we'll have to see as we go forward. Now it's 26 minutes past the hour of 6 o'clock. The morning show this Friday morning, Pam Brown and Michael G. Haskins are your hosts this Friday morning. And before we move on to Real World with Mike Sargent, I just want to focus on Bergen County, New Jersey. And I am have contact with Paula Rogovin, who lives in Teaneck, New Jersey. And we've been talking over the past months, actually, since last year, about these Bakken crude oil trains coming through communities all over the United States and right here in New Jersey, right in our listening area. Residents in Bergen County are really concerned about what's going on. I just want to read just a little bit of this press release that they have. Bergen County residents here bearing flashlights remain dry as they gathered in the heavy rain and winds under a large overhang outside Teaneck's Community Charter School to shine light on what they term the triple threat of trains carrying Bakken crude oil through their communities. The highly volatile oil enters the state in Northvale on CSX River Line. From there, it passes through northern Bergen County and south to Philadelphia, to a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania refinery. And the Bakken crude oil, it's very volatile. It's transported in substandard tank cars that are prone to derailment and can explode. We recall the explosion and the incineration of a town in Canada a few years ago. So the community in Bergen County are very concerned about that, and they are demonstrating regularly. And I'm going to reach out again to Paula Rogovin or another representative from one of the groups, because there are a number of groups that are involved. Ban Safe, Ban Unsafe Oil Trains.org. That's Ban Unsafe Oil Trains.org for more information about what's going on in Bergen County. And I hope that you will do that, and we'll have some people on in the coming days to give us some insights into what's going on there in Bergen County. This is The Morning Show, a Friday edition of The Morning Show at 99.5 FM WBAI. It's just about 6:30 here in New York. And wherever you are, you know, we have an online component. People are not just listening on the radio. Although, Pam, as you said yesterday, as you were traveling into New York, into Manhattan, that you were listening to WBAI on the car radio.
Oftentimes, we do that. That's actually the only radio that we have.
Well, see, there you go. The only radio that you have. I have one other radio. I used to have a stereo. Not anymore. Just I've been reduced to
digital device that doesn't
digital
have
platform.
An antenna,
that's right?
Right?
Not happy about that, but that's what it is. And what it is
But by the way, I will say that the app for WBAI is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And you can listen on that app for sure.
Okay. All right. So listen.
Or via that app, I should say.
That's right. So check out the app for WBAI and Pacifica in general. It's 6:30 on a Friday morning again. Coming up next, Real World with Mike Sargent.
You're tuned to Listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI, and I'm Mike Sargent, and this is Real World. There are 19 movies coming out today, and I'm going to talk to you about three of them. The first, of course.
Nothing good is safe while Snow's alive. But I can't make another speech about it. Snow has to pay for what he's done.
One way or another, this war's going to come to an end. There's only one thing you could do now to add more fire to this rebellion.
We all have one enemy. He corrupts everyone and everything. He turns the best of us against each other.
And no, she's not talking about Donald Trump. Unless you've been living under a rock for the last 5 years, you must know that young adult fiction has taken over the box office, and The Hunger Games is coming to its conclusion with The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2. It stars, of course, Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, Liam Hemsworth, Philip Seymour Hoffman in what is his last role, and there's a little bit of digital Philip Seymour Hoffman in there. This film concludes what has begun in the previous three films. I, for one, of course, I'm a science fiction fan, but I found the first film to be somewhat lacking. I felt that the premise was not really fleshed out. I didn't completely buy it. I enjoyed the second film a lot more because I thought it dealt much more with the society and the impact some of the concepts in the first film and in the premise and the storyline itself went to. Third film was okay. This film concludes it all, and I will say it's full of some solid writing, very good acting, some great action sequences. And if you're a Hunger Games fan, and I saw it with an audience of women in there from late teens to early 20s, and this is definitely a movie for them. We're living in the age of the female action hero, and as you keep hearing in Hollywood, Jennifer Lawrence, of course, has been in the news for writing an op-ed about the disparity between what A-list female stars get paid and what A-list male stars get paid. I do think that she's going to get paid quite well after doing this film. The film has a great score, and like I said, it's directed very well, but for me, the best part of this movie is Donald Sutherland. He is deliciously evil as President Snow, who, of course, is the evil dictator who runs this world the way it is now in the world of the Hunger Games. I, for one, could say it's a solid movie. I do think it's kind of bizarre that Lionsgate, who puts out this film, is about to open up, coming next year, Hunger Games theme park. And it's ironic, considering the Hunger Games is some children who are killed for the entertainment of adults. To turn that into an entertainment theme park seems a little bizarre to me. The next film, The Night Before. The Night Before is another film that you could call a stoner comedy. This one stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Anthony Mackie, and of course, Seth Rogen. I can't really tell the writing between Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who is actually the person who directed and co-wrote this film, along with three other credited writers, but this is a film that unfortunately for me falls somewhat flat. I am not a fan of Seth Rogen and that whole cadre of players that he's often with, though I did like This Is the End. I found that surprisingly funny. This one is pretty much what you expect. interesting to see Anthony Mackie, who I think drank the Kool-Aid, and recently some of the comments he's been making about supporting Trump and saying that Marvel's movie version of the Black Panther doesn't need a black director. To quote him, "You didn't need a horse to direct Seabiscuit." It's interesting for him to play a role that clearly was written by white men to be this black character. I didn't find the film that funny. It was amusing. There's a lot of homoerotic humor, which I don't understand why it's in every film this team seems to do, and they seem to hit you over the head with the same joke over and over again throughout. There are a lot of cameos in it. Mindy Kaling shows up. Tracy Morgan is doing the narration. And, of course, James Franco shows up at a certain point. The film probably is better if you're stoned. I wasn't when I saw it, so I only chuckled. Our last film is a film that's an interesting semi-failure. It's called The Secret in Their Eyes. It's got a great cast. It stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, Julia Roberts, Nicole Kidman, and Dean Norris, who you may know from Breaking Bad. And the premise is they're a team of investigators, FBI investigators, who uncover, I don't want to give too much away, but the murder of the daughter of one of the team. And this, of course, has ramifications that are felt for a number of years because their attempts to capture and prosecute the person who committed this awful act of rape and murder is stifled by the fact that he's an informant for the government. The film deals with some very interesting political issues and social issues, and it definitely has some very good performances. It's told in a fractured narrative. We start in the present, we flash back to the past, we go back and forth from the present to the past, and we kind of fill in all the blanks. This is a movie that I definitely think, as good as the cast is, everybody was pretty much miscast. There's no chemistry between the characters, and there seriously needs to be for the plot. And as much as I like Chiwetel Ejiofor, I would rather have seen someone else in this role. Julia Roberts, I say, is pretty brave for doing probably the most unglamorous role of her career. Nicole Kidman pretty much looks like a stiff, cold Barbie doll. And though she's a solid actress, she comes across, unfortunately, that way, and it hurts the film. In the movie, everyone ages 13 years. Except her character. She changes her hairstyle, but literally her makeup and everything are exactly the same. So this is a film that you watch it. I enjoyed some things about it. It's got some twists. It's really kind of a movie. The lapses in logic, hopefully you'll forgive with the pacing. But I can't really recommend it. I would wait till it's on cable. I'm Mike Sargent. This has been Real World. I'll be back next week with some more interesting films. Hopefully some better films. Until then, see you at the movies.
That was Real World, produced by Mike Sargent. We thank you, Mike, for that. It's 6:39 here in New York City on The Morning Show with Pam Brown and Michael G. Haskins, the 20th day of November, 2015. The 20th day of November. Pam, what's the temperature now? Because I've given the wrong temperature once, and I don't want to do that again. What do we got?
It's about 58 degrees right now.
58.
Actually, it's saying 56
okay.
Now already.
All right, and it's heading
down.
It's going down.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's going down.
All right. Before we move on to conversation that we had with the part of the delegation from France, from the part of the EU, on Mumia, wanting justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Let's just run through quickly this date in history. And on this date in history, November 20th, 1816, the term scab was first used in print by the Albany, New York Typographical Society. A scab is someone who crosses a union's picket line and takes the job of a striking worker.
Gee, I didn't realize that that went back to 1816. Yeah, yeah. I would have thought late 1800s. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1945, the International War Crimes Tribunal began in Nuremberg, Germany, and continued until October 1st, 1946, establishing that military and political subordinates are responsible for their own actions, even if ordered by superiors. 24 high-ranking Nazis were on trial for atrocities committed during World War II, ranging from crimes against peace to crimes of war to crimes against humanity. The Nuremberg trials were conducted by judges from the United States, the Soviet Union, France, and Great Britain.
It's something to think about for right here in the United States, for some of the things that have been done in your and my names.
That's right. That's right. I think about that all the time.
Yeah. Also on this date, in 1959, the United Nations proclaimed the Declaration of the Rights of the Child because, quote, the child, by reason of his physical and mental immaturity, needs special safeguards and care, including appropriate legal protection before as well as after birth, unquote.
And in 1969, 14 Indians from 20 tribes seized Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, offering to buy the island from the federal government for $24 worth of beads. The alleged price paid to the Carnassie Delaware Indians for Manhattan Island was actually 60 Dutch guilders. Their numbers swelled to nearly 80. The General Services Administration, which had responsibility for the site of the former federal prison, and the Coast Guard gave them the opportunity to leave the island peacefully. They were reclaiming it as Indian land by right of discovery and demanding fairness and respect for Native peoples. The occupation lasted for more than a year, said Richard Oakes, a Mohawk from New York. We hold the rock.
And finally, this date in history, November 20th, 1987, SANE, the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and FREEZE, the campaign to freeze all testing of nuclear weapons, merged at their first combined convention in Cleveland, Ohio, becoming the largest U.S. peace organization. That's going to do it for this date in history here on WBAI's Morning Show. :43 on Friday morning. Good morning, everyone, and thanks so much for tuning in.
And about, I guess it was on November 10th, Michael and I had on our show a conversation about a delegation from France coming to the United States, actually, to support the campaign for justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal, someone who we hear quite a lot about on this station. And we had an opportunity to pre-record an interview. I guess that was on, I'm sorry that I'm having a hard time remembering. I think it was on November the 11th. I'm actually sure it was November the 11th. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting conversation that we had with a French delegation. They're all from the campaign to bring Mumia home. And one of them, to give you the names of the guests, it was Patrick Leharic, who is a European Parliament member and a vice chair of the European United Left Nordic Green Left Group. And we had another guest here, Jackie Horteau, and actually one other, Claude Guillemot, and they're both members of the French coalition to free Mumia. And we thought it was really interesting, I think both you and I, that people would come, in fact, not just people, but dignitaries mm-hmm. would come from France to not only demand his release, but frankly demand proper medical treatment. Care. All of this has gotten back to France. This something? Obviously was recorded before the recent news, and we have a abbreviated version of that conversation. We're going to play, I guess, part of that.
Mm-hmm, part of that.
This is WBAI New York, and this is The Morning Show with Pam Brown and Michael G. Haskins. Today we are pre-recording an interview with Patrick Leharic, who is member of the European Parliament as well as editor of a French publication, a French left publication called Le Humanité. He is here in New York with a delegation, which includes Claude Pujol, who will be translating, Mary Ringot, who is his assistant, and Jackie Lahorthout, I believe. I think I've messed up that name pretty badly, but hopefully they'll excuse that my French is terrible. And they're here in New York because of the campaign to free Mumia. The delegation is organized by leaders of the Collectif Français Libérons Mumia, one of the French groups involved in international support work for Mumia. And they're here to address and report on the failure of the Department of Corrections to treat Mumia with hepatitis C meds, as well as the other 10,000 other prisoners in Pennsylvania who have sued the Department of Corrections for failing to treat them for the same problem. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us today. My first question for you is, what made you get involved in this issue? From an American perspective, we always think this is something that's happening here, but it's wonderful and also surprising to hear of international support.
Pourquoi est-ce que tu es ici aujourd'hui? Pourquoi est-ce que nous sommes ici aujourd'hui? Comment est-ce que nous avons connu le problème? Et du point de vue américain, c'est surprenant qu'on puisse s'intéresser au problème de la santé des prisonniers américains et Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Ben, nous sommes sensibilisés sur les enjeux de la discrimination raciale, des violences policières aux États-Unis.
So we just are very sensitive, we are very outraged by racial discrimination and the number of prisoners and the treatment of prisoners in the U.S., which were, you know, finding out, discovering, and discussing.
And how long has the organization in France been working on this campaign to free Mumia?
Depuis combien de temps est-ce que le collectif Mumia et le journal travaille soutient Mumia?
Depuis 20 ans, puisque dès ce moment ont été organisées des manifestations publiques en France et de l'information autour de Mumia et pour qu'on cesse ici comme ailleurs la peine de mort comme châtiment.
It's been going on for 20 years, okay? Support for Mumia started in 1995 when it was about to be executed. That's when we had the first major events in Paris, in Place de la Concorde. And l'Humanité has been at a journalist in Philadelphia in 1995 also. So it's a long time campaign, and including the case of Mumia, the case of prisoners, and we are, of course, anti-death penalty people worldwide.
And how do you connect the issues of these political prisoners who are left over, I guess you could say, at least from the 60s oftentimes in the United States, with the issue of the death penalty and the issue of policing in general?
Donc, quel rapport fais-tu entre tous ces gens qui sont en prison depuis les années 60 et surtout pour des raisons politiques, et puis des brutalités policières, voilà, comment ça...
C'est une société qui, malheureusement, criminalise celles et ceux qui n'ont pas une couleur de peau blanche, les pauvres. Et cette criminalisation vise vraisemblablement à remplir des prisons pour ne pas remplir les bureaux d'embauche publique.
So basically, we see it. We see all these people being imprisoned and for political reason, as part of a general policy of controlling the poor and the minorities, and rather shutting them down in prison rather than opening social service, education, and that kind of thing.
Patrick, do you mind if I call you Patrick? Is that fine? Patrick, thank you. I want to piggyback on what Pam said, her first comment to you, about the people of France. Of course, you're not the entirety of the population of France, but how do others in France look at this issue? Are they familiar with this issue? Do they care about or interested in this issue? Or is this just a small subset of the population of France? I'm curious
about
that.
J'entends bien ce que tu dis, mais est-ce que ton point de vue sur la discrimination raciale, problème des prisonniers, est-ce que c'est juste quelques personnes comme toi en France qui s'intéressent à ça, ou s'il y a plus de gens passionnés par intéressés par pour soutenir ces gens-là?
Non, il y avait en France une tradition progressiste qui transcendait tous les courants politiques.
So there is a kind of progressive, I say historical turn of mind in France with human rights, okay? And it goes beyond political divide and it's beyond nationalism. Okay?
It's international. Et nous battrons avec beaucoup d'énergie pour faire reculer les discriminations raciales, la discrimination envers les pauvres ici, pour la simple raison que c'est en train de nous menacer en Europe.
And we are all the more adamant, focusing on this fight against discrimination against minorities and poor people, as we are afraid that it's spreading over to our country. That's why we are fighting back so strongly.
Il faut que vous sachiez que nous sommes en train de vivre en Europe une période et un climat de régression culturelle, idéologique et politique.
Presently in Europe, we're in the middle of a crisis, cultural crisis, economic crisis, and people tend to have a regressive mind and become much more conservative.
Et en Europe, nous sommes contaminés, enfin, les forces de la droite et une partie des forces de gauche sont contaminées par ce qui est apparu ici et en Angleterre, le Reaganisme et le Thatcherisme.
Reaganism and Thatcherism, okay, is more or less contaminating many people in Europe, whether on the left or on the right side.
Et donc des forces sont en train de nous expliquer en France et dans toute l'Union européenne que ce sont les méthodes qui sont en vigueur ici qui doivent être appliquées, ce que nous refusons.
So the, you know, people, politicians, officials are trying to convince us that we should play by the American rule, okay? And so we really protest against this. We resist. Okay?
Et donc il y a un combat solidaire entre les populations ici les plus démunies et nos populations dans nos villes, notamment nos villes de banlieue, qui elles aussi sont victimes de discrimination et de racisme.
So poor people at home and suburban population feel solidarity toward, you know, American poor people, American racial ethnic minorities, because we are all fighting for the same cause, you know.
Mm-hmm. You see, and we did not know that. We don't know that. The press is not telling us any of that kind of information. That's why this conversation is so important. That's why our radio station is so important.
Et nous, personne dans les journaux, dans la presse, nous parle de ça. On n'a aucune idée de ce genre de choses. C'est pour ça que c'est important que tu viennes ici et que tu en parles à notre radio.
Oui, je comprends. Mais vous savez, il vient d'y avoir à Paris une manifestation essentiellement de jeunes contre les discriminations et le racisme qui a réuni 15 000 personnes.
Recently in Paris, 50,000 young people organized and marched in Paris streets against discrimination, against racial discrimination. So it was something new.
Et il y a des forces qui poussent pour qu'on revienne au même système de justice que le vôtre, c'est-à-dire la suppression du juge d'instruction. L'ancien président de la République vient de dire que désormais, pour la circulation routière sur autoroute, ça pourrait être des sociétés privées qui contrôlent et non plus la police publique nationale. Donc, c'est une quasi-copie de ce qui se fait de moins bien ici, de plus mal ici.
So they're more or less trying to sell us, even our president, okay, who is a supposedly left-wing president, they are trying to sell us, you know, this kind of corporate system, okay? For instance, Patrick is taking the example of what you call a freeway on which you pay when you drive at home, you know?
A toll and, road, yeah, toll we call road, that a toll road.
Okay, where we have speed control, speed radar, and the suggestion of the government, the recent suggestion of the government, is that it should be enforced by private companies, no longer by the state police, you know? Mm-hmm. That's one of the kind of, you know, vicious thing which we are trying to impose on us.
Mm-hmm. Des forces nous disent qu'il faut désormais faire des fichiers ethniques. Donc, vous voyez que ça pousse extrêmement loin.
And there are suggestions about having ethnic IDs, you know, which is something new for us. We, you know, there's nothing like race officially in France, you know. Mm-hmm. So, we're just trying to play it the American way, I mean, you know.
That's very interesting. Ethnic IDs. This was the conversation that we had with the delegation from the EU, from France. It was last Wednesday, I believe it was.
That's right.
And talking about their coming to see Mumia Abu-Jamal, very, very concerned and very impassioned about the condition that Mumia Abu-Jamal is in right now, and this ahead of the horrific terrorist attack in Paris on Friday. It would be very interesting, and you know, perhaps we can reach out to them to get a comment from them to gauge and judge their feelings after this attack.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting. I don't think that we got up to the part where we asked them about the connection between sort of their work with the Mumia struggle and this idea of Je suis Charlie, which was really interesting. Maybe we can play that on another, maybe on Tuesday. We'll find time in the 6 o'clock hour to play the rest of it, because I think that that was very interesting, especially in light of this attack, because really they didn't see any connection between the assertion of, you know, I am Charlie as anything other than I am, you know, I am, it's about liberté is what he said. And that was interesting in contrast to what so many African Americans felt when, you know, I am Trayvon became, I am a, you know, racist cartoon character. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So it was really interesting.
It really was, and I'm really glad that we got the opportunity to speak to those folks. And Pam, you know, you arranged that the week before, finding out that they were coming into town, and reaching out to them, and they, you know, said most assuredly that they would stop by our studios. And, you know, as always, when people come from out of town and they come in to WBAI, I'm going to talk about my radio station, our radio station, because it is just that. It is our radio station, and we have to keep it.
You know, one thing I should mention is that immediately when they came into the space, I think we were somewhat apologetic in a sense, and saying, well, this is our space after Sandy.
Right.
But they only knew WBAI from France as a very famous and highly regarded station.
I didn't
they
hear
were
that
really,
part of
yeah,
it. I was,
absolutely. They absolutely said that, and it was kind of touching. But I could see that, of course, they were probably surprised by the kind of studio that we're operating in. And they're still always available, the WBAI Buddy. And if listeners can and are inclined, You can become a WBAI buddy. I believe that you get a tote bag and perhaps some other discounts and stuff. But the radio station really does need support to continue with this kind of programming,
right,
and to improve it, because I know that we would have, and Michael did the editing himself. He doesn't really talk much about how much work he does around the station, but it is an incredible amount of labor that he puts in to make the daily morning show actually happen.
And I want to also applaud the work of my colleagues, the other colleagues in the operations department, Reggie Johnson and Max Schmid.
That's right.
And not to, you know, to negate the work that Tony Ryan has done, and Grayson Challenger now has come on to help us try to get through and sort through this phone business. And so we're all trying to make this work and make this happen here at WBAI, and we appreciate and thank all of you for participating and helping us sustain WBAI. I know the frequency of the membership drives are all too often and certainly too long, but thank you for staying with us. This is our radio station. As the Occupied people used to say, we're here and we ain't going nowhere. And you know where that here is? In the middle of the FM dial in New York City. How about that? We're here and we ain't going nowhere. Pam, it's 7:01 here in New York City. Speaking of which, 99.5 FM WBAI. And if you're joining us outside of our primary listening area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and parts of Pennsylvania, you're listening to us online at WBAI.org. You have the WBAI app, the Pacifica app. Use that. Take us mobily, and spread the word about radio station WBAI. Pam in Pam Brown is the host sitting across from me. Usually Mario Murillo is the host on Friday, my comrade on Friday. Mario's away doing some other projects, and he will be back from time to time with specials and some live appearances as well. But throughout the rest of this year, Pam Brown is going to be sitting in part, not every Friday.
Unfortunately, not every Friday.
Not every Friday. I would welcome you, believe me.
No.
I would welcome you. But on some days, and there'll be some other hosts here next week and so on. But Pam, what do we have for our final hour of the program?
For our final hour, and it always goes so fast, we are going to hear what's happening at Princeton University.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an unlikely place for a little student rebellion, but they did take over the president's office, and they were able to negotiate they made some progress, really, on the demand to remove Woodrow Wilson's name from the campus, actually. And we are going to speak with Jonathan McCory, who is the director of a fantastic play, Dead and Breathing. It is at the National Black Theater right now, and it will be ending. This is the last weekend. I think the last night of it is Monday. And we're going to hear about that ongoing 47-year-old project of this incredible theater. I've seen the play.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great.
Wow.
And then we're going to hear from the New York African Diaspora Film Festival, which is another ongoing project, very important one. And we're going to hear from, I guess, the organizers, right, Michael?
That's right.
The organizers of that
the
festival.
The co-director and co-founder, Rinaldo Barroso Speck, will be joining us online talking about this. Is in its 27th year, the film festival, the African Diaspora International Film Festival, in its 27th year. So we'll be talking to him about some of the films that they will be featuring on this year, this holiday season.
Amazing. And we are going to wrap things up today with a project that Michael's been working on. I want to hear more about this project, Michael, but mm-hmm. It's the reading of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And it's been played every day. I guess we're going to be playing it on each morning show until it's over.
We're going to try as best we can. We're looking to do that, to feature it during the morning show. But we're going to see what we can do We'll work on that as best we can. Right now, it is 7:04, and first things first, as always, we have news with Linda Perry.
Good morning. Here's some of the news for Friday morning, November 20th, 2015. Today is the one-year anniversary of the death of 28-year-old Akai Gurley. He was killed by NYPD officer Peter Liang in a stairwell at the Pink Houses in East New York. This while Liang and his partner, NYPD officer Sean Landau, patrolled the NYCHA building. Liang was indicted by a Brooklyn grand jury on multiple charges, including second-degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. Liang's partner received immunity in exchange for testifying against Officer Liang. The family continues to seek justice for Akai Gurley. Today, the committee, along with Gurley's mom, Sylvia Palmer, and Kimberly Ballinger, the mom of Gurley's daughter, will meet with Brooklyn DA Ken Thompson and Assistant DA Mark Fleidner about the case. Shavon Ford is a member of the Justice for Akai Gurley Family Committee.
What we've been doing over this past year is that we were able to get, and we meaning the family support committee, we were able to get the officer indicted in February of this year. And now we actually, this fall, we got the case to go to trial, and which is going to be set to take place at early next year.
Ford says the family and the Gurley Justice Committee are on a road to receiving justice.
What we've been doing over this past year is that we were able to get, and we meaning the family support committee, we were able to get the officer indicted in February of this year. And now we actually, this fall, we got the case to go to trial, and which is going to be set to take place at early next year.
The trial for NYPD officer Peter Liang in the killing of Akai Gurley will begin in January of 2016. This evening, beginning at 6:30, the family will hold a rally to honor Akai Gurley.
It's a rally to show the community that we're still here. We're still concerned about what happened to Akai Gurley a year ago. And we're also here with taking the mother to the site so that she can visit where her son was actually killed a year ago. Akai's mom has never set foot into the Pink Houses where he tragically lost his life. And we're going to be having her there with other members of his family that are going for the first time. And it's going to be a very sobering moment because, you know, a year later we have made strides, and we just want the community to know that we are grateful for their support in the community, meaning the police brutality movement as a whole, as well as the residents in the Pink Houses. We want them to know that, you know, we're still here. We're fighting for justice not only for Akai, but for the larger East New York, Brooklyn community as well.
That's 6:30 for the rally at the Lewis Pink Houses, 724 Linden Boulevard in Brooklyn, New York. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Es una selva de cemento y de fieras salvajes, como no. Ya no hay quien salga loco de contento. Donde quiera te espera lo peor. Alimaña, con mucha maña llega al mostrador, saca su cuchillo sin preocupación, dice que le entreguen la registradora, saca los billetes, saca un pistolón, ¡pum! Sale como el viento en su disparada, y aunque ya lo vieron, nadie ha visto nada. Juanito Alimaña va a la fechoría, se toma su caña, fabrica su orgía. La gente le teme porque esté cuidado, pa' meterle mano hay que ser un bravo. Si lo meten preso, sale al otro día.
Juanito Limaña, Willie Colon, and Hector Lavoe at 7:10 on a Friday morning here in New York City on WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins in studio this Friday morning with Pam Brown. And I was on the air yesterday, and I received a text message about an event that was happening right in our area in Princeton, New Jersey. And students at Princeton University were having a sit-in at the president's office, the president of the university, and others are protesting in support of them. The students at Princeton are protesting racism, injustice, inequality at colleges and universities across the country. These students at Princeton deserve our support and our respect, just as the students in Minnesota. But I have on the line right now one of the students involved in this protest at the president's office, Destiny Crockett. She joins us online this morning, a very fatigued Destiny Crockett. So we're going to have her on and speak with her and let her get to some sleep as soon as she gets off the line with us. Destiny Crockett, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So Destiny, let's jump right into it. What is going on at Princeton University? Why the demonstration? Why the sit-in at the president's office? And who is involved? Tell us about it.
Sure. So we're a group, and we're called Black Justice League. We're a group of about 15 different students. Most of us are Black, but we also have a couple of Latina students, or Latinx students. And we formed a year ago. So in November of 2014, we were protesting police brutality just along with everybody else in the country. And we decided to take those issues and make them introspective, right? Because though, like, I'm from St. Louis, we could stand in solidarity. We protest police brutality in, like, the New Jersey area. But what was most important to us at that time was to talk about issues on our campus that were directly affecting Black students there. And so we made a few demands. One of them was to get the African American Studies Center to become a department so that people can major in it. And we were able to accomplish that. So that was a victory. Another one was to get a task force made up of faculty, administrators, and selected students. Called like the Diversity and Inclusion Task Force. So we were able to get that done too, but we also felt that a lot of issues in that process were swept under the rug. So one of the things that we also wanted to focus on was the racist legacy of Woodrow Wilson on campus. And so we know that like changing the name of the Woodrow Wilson School, the graduate school, doesn't single-handedly dismantle racism, right? So we're not naive enough to think that, but we also, as one of the elders who came in there and spoke to us, think it's important to acknowledge the way that Woodrow Wilson's legacy is what she called sticking to the wall.
Wait, who came to speak to you, Destiny? Who spoke to you?
Dr. Ruth Simmons, former president of Brown University.
Mm-hmm. Destiny, for our listeners, can you explain what's wrong with having, you know, the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Affairs, I think it's called. Woodrow Wilson, I think there's a statue perhaps on your campus. What's wrong with all of this symbolism and naming around Woodrow Wilson?
Sure. So what we do know, and what the president of the university also conceded to, was that Woodrow Wilson was a known racist, right? And so it's rumors that there were ties to the Klan. And Woodrow Wilson was also the president of Princeton University long before he was the president of the United States. And he worked very hard to keep Black students out of Princeton University, and for a long time, Jewish students out of the university. And he specifically said the very nature of the place is such so that no Negro student would ever be comfortable, and worked to make sure that no Negro student could ever be comfortable. And so it's fine to acknowledge what he actually did contribute to the university, but we know that it's potentially sets a precedent when the School of International and Public Affairs is named after him. So what does that say to students who study in that school about the way we venerate him and the way he approached policy, both in the institution and in the nation?
Destiny, I'm sorry, what's on your campus? What are the results of this legacy of Woodrow Wilson? Do Black students feel comfortable on the campus today?
Well, we, first of all, are deliberate about not speaking for all Black students on the campus and nationally, right? But what we know about us and the Black students that we associate with are that in a lot of ways we're sometimes uncomfortable with our interactions with certain faculty as well as students. So that leads me to our other demands, which one of them was for cultural competency training for faculty, not just white faculty, all faculty. And another one was for students to have to take a class on the history of marginalized peoples. So we have distributional requirements, which are basically the classes that are required for us to take to graduate. But we think it's just as important for people to have to learn about the history of marginalized peoples as it is for them to have to take a math or a science class.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking with Destiny Crockett, and you are a student at Princeton University. Where are you in your academic life at Princeton?
I'm a junior.
You're a junior. Speaking of feeling comfortable, since this action, since you took this action, what has been the response from the rest of the Princeton community, the faculty, and the other students?
Sure. So when we originally sat in, decided to do a walkout at 11:30, and we were all by the president in the president's office by about 12 p.m. So this is after we read our demands. And about 150 students followed the 15 members of Black Justice League into that building and into the president's office. And we had food delivered and all of that. And so we stayed until about 5, and we were threatened by an administrator who basically said, if you stay after this, when the building gets closed, you'll be in violation. We'll have to report this to the Judiciary Committee so that they can take action.
Mm-hmm.
And we were then told that if you just come back tomorrow, the doors will be open. But we couldn't trust that. We couldn't trust that because some of our people who left who wanted to come back but thought that they would be able to come back because Nassau Hall is a public building during certain times of the day weren't able to come back because we were told that the doors would be open, but they were locked. So we didn't believe that. We decided to sleep over. So there were 17 of us who slept on the floor of the president's office. Other than that, the alumni, particularly the Black alumni, have been very supportive.
Mm.
So some of them called into the president's office and read our demand.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the white students? I can recall, maybe it was just over a year ago, an article by a Princeton student saying that he would never apologize for his white male privilege. So I can only imagine there may have been some blowback from other students on campus.
Sure. So first of all, that's Exhibit A of why classes on diversity are important. And he's not the only one like that. There are like-minded students like him. So we got people saying things on Yik Yak like rest in peace, Black Justice League, and how we're whiny, how Black people are always whiny, and that if we don't like it here, we can just go somewhere else. But we also know that our institution was almost quite literally built on the backs of Black people. And so we do think that we're entitled to this space because we earned it. And we don't think that if we don't like it, we should just go elsewhere. So that's not really something that we tried to pay a lot of attention to, because while we were in the president's office overnight, so it seems like at a sit-in, you just sit, there was a lot of strategizing, and we didn't really have time to detract from the movement.
Good, good. It's really great to hear you articulate these things the way you're doing so. And I just want to say, you know, on behalf of us here in the studio, and I know many listeners tuning in right now feel similarly, I'm incredibly proud of you for what you and the Black Justice League have done for other students around the country. And I want you to know that, you know, you have friends here, you have a voice here. You know, this is a
a radio station in New York in the middle of the FM dial, and we are here at your disposal because this is some of what we should be doing,
mm-hmm.
reaching out to talking about young people, reaching out to young people when they take these bold steps. We're here for you. We're very, very proud of you and your colleagues and your student colleagues, Destiny.
Absolutely. Destiny.
I'd like to say one more thing.
Yeah, and I have one more question for you as well. Go ahead.
Well, I just would like to say that we talked about the students who slept inside, and I was one of them. But when students learned they couldn't get back inside, there were students who slept on tents outside, and it was cold outside, and I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I want to just second what Michael said. I've been involved in different kinds of student actions myself, and I think that this was a very successful one. And I'm wondering, though, what's next? I mean, you've made some progress, but there's been acknowledgement that Woodrow Wilson was in fact a racist, but it did seem that there was pushback saying, well, we should contextualize him in his time,
mm-hmm,
and the same kind of rhetoric that we always hear, and tools to sort of pacify. What's next for your student group? Are you going to continue to protest until you have Woodrow Wilson's name actually removed?
So we got a few things out. So the reason we ultimately left was because we got a particular document signed, which did not say that Woodrow Wilson's name will be removed, because what we do know is that the president of Princeton University alone doesn't have nearly as much power as the Board of Trustees, which is just a fact.
Yeah.
So we got him to sign a document saying that he would have us in a meeting with the Board of Trustees as soon as possible and put that issue at the forefront. So as soon as possible meant last night for a minute, until it turned out that we weren't able to get out until like 9 p.m. What he also said was that he would start the process immediately. His exact words were tonight, of doing what it takes to get the mural of Woodrow Wilson taken down in the dining hall, one of the dining halls. And there's also a working group that will have an expedited process of getting the classes for like the diversity distribution requirement done.
Well, we again appreciate you being with us this morning on the morning show. I know you've been up for many, many hours, Destiny Crockett. We thank you for taking the time to speak with us, to speak with our audience, and let us know what's going on and to support you. How can people, speaking of supporting you, is there something, is there some place that you can direct people that might be interested in, you know, maybe just reaching out and supporting you with an email or in any other way? Is there somewhere where people could go?
Sure. So we do have a change.org petition, and I haven't looked at the amount of signatures this morning yet, mm-hmm. but as of around 2 or 3 a.m., I think, there are well over 800 signatures,
mm-hmm.
and it had only been up for about 6 or 7 hours. So people can definitely support by still going there and still signing. And people can also leave comments on there indicating what their relationship to the university is, if
mm-hmm.
there is one,
mm-hmm.
And like a way that they could be contacted. And Black Justice League, and Black Justice League also had, like, that's connected to our Facebook page. And so, like, our Facebook name for all of our events is Black Justice League. So
okay.
We've been getting a lot of messages through there.
Okay, great. Black Justice League or the change.org. Destiny Crockett, student at Princeton University, thank you so much for being on the morning show on WBAI this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Destiny.
Thank you.
All right. And just remember that, you have a home here. You definitely have a home. Listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio WBAI at 99.5 FM. And before we move on, I just want to say that what you just heard would not be possible without community involvement, because that's how I found out about it. It wasn't through the internet. It wasn't through a phone call. Somebody from the community got in touch with me, sent me a text saying, Michael, this is happening. This might be something that you'd be interested in. Well, of course it is. Absolutely. And that's what I'm here to do. And I'm going to make sure that that is what I do. going forward here on this morning show. So don't get it twisted. If you think something else is going to happen, it's not. That's what I'm going to be doing. That's what we're going to be doing. That is why WBAI, in part, is here. Let us pray. 7:25 on a Friday morning. It's the 20th day of November 2015. Pam Brown, I'm Michael G. Haskins. We're your hosts this Friday morning. This music is the Edinburgh Choral Society. And if you like this kind of music, if you're interested in this, you may want to tune in on Sunday morning for Spirit Ascending. It's hosted by Chris Wendt at 8 a.m. from 8 until 9 o'clock. And then at 9 a.m. from 9 until 11, here of a Sunday morning, also hosted by Chris Wendt, one of our finest programs here on WBAI. So that's here of a Sunday morning with Chris Wendt, 9 to 11 a.m. And right before that, he hosts Spirit Ascending. 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.
And now we are pleased to be joined by Harlem-based Jonathan McCrory, who is an Obie Award-winning artist, currently the director of the theater arts program at Dr. Barbara Ann Tier's National Black Theater. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be on the radio.
And I grabbed you last night after I had the pleasure of seeing a wonderful production called Dead and Breathing at the National Black Theater. Can you tell us a little bit about that production?
Yeah, so Dead and Breathing is a powerful two-handler piece dealing with terminal illness, but in a comedic, funny way. It's the opportunity for us as a community to look at how we take care of each other, how do we reveal our humanity to each other, how do we like love each other beyond what we think, and how do we bring our whole everything of who we are into a space and into a room. It is a comedic, funny. Hopefully you laughed a lot, but you also had an opportunity through that laughter to really see a reflection of how we police each other through language and through words, and also how we sometimes judge before we really fully get to appreciate the beauty within each other.
I absolutely did laugh a lot. I should mention that you were the director of this production. Can you just tell us the name of the writer?
Yeah, so Dead and Breathing was written by Chisa Hutchinson. And it is performed by veteran actor Lizanne Mitchell and also another actress by the name of Nikki Walker.
They were absolutely fantastic, and the script was it was really well done. I have to say that I was not only laughing but also really touched by certain things because my own father has a home health aide. As he is aged, he's 89, he'll be 90 in January, and so many of the dynamics of the relationship rang true, because the truth is that he once complained about one of the aides that he had. She's no longer a part of his life because of this, but singing religious songs all the time in the house, and it was just really exactly right on. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this story as well? This was actually based on a real life character.
Yeah. So it's based off of the playwright's aunt, Veronica Sabuiz, who is in San Francisco. She's a pioneering nurse. She's been a nurse for 38 years. It's basically based off of her very honest and real life. Which makes it kind of have that sensibility that you just had, which is the biggest compliment ever, that you actually feel like you are in a situation where you see your father, a reflection of your father. I think that was what we were looking for when we picked the piece as a production, but also as we were going through the rehearsal process, was how do we allow people to go on an honest journey that allows them to see their family members, but not see it from a sad space, but see it from possibly a joyous space, or to see another perspective of it. How do we deal with hospice care? I think when we think about it, we think of it as a sad thing because it's talking about end of life care. But at the same time, there's all of us in some point, in some aspect, might have to face this very question. Have to live with people who have to go through this, or ourselves will have to go through cancer or go through hospice care. And I think that this production is a unique opportunity to look at it, not from a sad space, but from a different angle, from multiple different angles, that then allow for us to then have possibly a different relationship. My mom, my grandmother's 95, my grandmother has a nurse within nurse. And my mom was like, afterwards, she was like, I got to see my grandmother's perspective in a different type of way. I never had a chance to have this type of conversation, this healing conversation around it. So it is definitely a very unique opportunity to look at something that we all sometimes deal with, and we secretly deal with. We don't always publicly talk about.
Jonathan, what was the healing nature of the conversation? Could you just flesh that out a bit and paint a little broader picture for our listeners?
Yeah. So that's right. I love that you asked that question, because National Black Theater, we've been around for 47 years, and at the very core of all of our work is around creating a healing narrative, a transformative healing narrative that helps to restore the autonomy, the beauty, the authenticity of the Black lifestyle, and giving it a really great and truthful portrayal. And so in everything that we do comes from the space of how is this narrative, how is this piece of artwork helping to create a healing vibration within our community? So we do it from we call it holistic producing. We do it from this very kind of holistic vantage point, where we align the production with very different, vibrations that allow to create a very kind of unique equation that people sometimes only get at MBT. Like, we do a dramaturgical lobby exhibition where we kind of, for this show, it's called Language, A Matrix to Our Identity, and really looking at how language is a source of labeling, but also liberation, that also polices us, that also gives us definition. And how do we claim the labels? How do we define the labels? And how does that matrix make us who we are from a police state, like how we police by those labels, but also how do we move past it? And by making that the first thing that audiences walk into, they're already in a space where they're thinking about, you know, language, words, identity, my own matrix. And so then when they're walking the play, they're seeing how art can be a vehicle for that. And then afterwards, beyond that, not just trying to give you just spaces for you to think by yourself, we do a discourse afterwards. We do a talk back after every show. It's our commitment, where we kind of help to complete the sentence that we started by utilizing our skill set, Sade, who's the CEO, and myself, our skill set of really creating dynamic space, of allowing the community now to breathe together. So I think all of that together really helps us to create a holistic space that that is unique, and it's really steeped into our founder's mission, Dr. Barbara Antier. She thought that all art had a vibration, so we're just continuing that sentence that she started of really making sure that all the art that we present has a very intentional vibration that we intend to be the vehicle for people's healing, for their awakening, for their transformation.
Jonathan, I think it's so beautiful, the idea of a holistic experience, because you do, for listeners who may be interested in seeing this play before it closes, unfortunately it closes on Monday evening, so you're going to have to really make an effort, and I encourage you all to do that, because you really will enjoy this production. But you will come into a space where you're immediately greeted and welcomed and made to feel a part of an experience. And then you can go through the exhibition in the lobby, which is interactive, then see the play itself, and then afterwards participate in this audience conversation and the cementing of this sense of community through this deep breath that everyone takes together before leaving. And it really creates a whole experience that listeners, I hope, will take advantage of. We're almost out of time. Jonathan, can you tell us, how can we see this play?
Yeah, so we have 5 more options for you to see the play. You can come tonight at 7:30. You can come tomorrow, which is Saturday, 2 and 7:30. You can come on Sunday at 4 o'clock, and you can come on Monday. Monday is our closing. That will be at 7:30. So these are 5 different opportunities to come see it. You can you can check out all the information on our website, which is National Black Theater, theater spelled with an re.org. You also can call us on our phone at the theater, which is 212-722-3800. And then lastly, you can go on our Facebook. There are very different ways to engage with us, and we would love to have listeners who are interested in the journey that this play will give to come and check it out.
So it's National Black Theater, spelled theatre.org.
Yes.
Am I right? .org?
Exactly.
And our tickets are still for sale. They are still available.
And they're affordable $40. So that's
let's just say they're affordable for our FCC license purposes. They're affordable.
They're affordable. Apologies.
Yes. Yes. That's all right. That's quite all right.
Thank you so much for joining us. We have been talking with Jonathan McCrory, who is the director of a fantastic play that hopefully all the listeners are going to rush to the website to buy tickets for. It's called Dead and Breathing. It is at the National Black Theater. And hopefully on another show, we will be able to talk more about that incredible ongoing 47-year-old project. Thank you so much for joining us early this morning, Jonathan McCrory.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. We do appreciate it. Supporting the arts, a lot of arts on this morning show. And I guess there's just one more thing to do. Of course, we're going to look at the New York African Diaspora Film Festival, Film Festival. Malika Lee Whitney, a storyteller and WBAI contributor at Revolution Books in Harlem for the Children's Hour. Look at that. The Children's Hour, 11 a.m. Saturday, the 21st. That's tomorrow at 427 Malcolm X Boulevard and 132nd Street. It's a grand opening weekend. Malika, the storyteller, Malika Lee Whitney, a storyteller and the contributor at WBAI, will be at Revolution Books. That's 11 a.m. tomorrow. All right. This is The Morning Show on radio station WBAI. Pam Brown and Michael G. Haskins are your hosts.
And it's been valuable for a long, long time. And you got folks who've had their eyes on this land, who want this land, they salivating. You know, they drooling at the lip. Because they want this land.
Mayor Daley is moving us out to get higher class people in. That's how I see it. People who can pay more money.
This is the largest transformation of public housing in the world. No one else wanted to tackle this issue because it's very complex and it's very difficult and deals mostly with poverty people.
Yeah, but aren't you supposed to be relocated to this area?
That's what they tell us. Do I believe them? No.
When Cabrini Green residents started coming in, there's a sentiment of, we feel like we're being outnumbered. And I don't know if it was more of an outnumbered by black people or if it was more just outnumbered by people who weren't middle class.
Some people get it. Some people really understand that they have to set an example for people who don't know what it's like to earn a living and to be proud of yourself and be proud of what you have.
There was this whole belief that if so-called public housing residents, if they move next door to such affluent neighbors, that would make them better people, which was very insulting.
I think there's a rage when you grow up and you know a community, you see that community get torn down, and then you see new people come in who expect things to change and expect you to change and say there's something wrong with you.
Here we go. Step, step, thigh to thigh, round and round, now bring it down, now separate, then bring it up, can't get enough, can't get enough. Step, step, thigh to thigh, round and round, watch out now.
Many of us fought against change, and somewhere along the line we understood that change is inevitable. And so how do you prepare for change? And that got to be the bigger picture. How do you prepare for change?
Then bring left in front. Now you step in. Step, step, thigh to thigh, round and round. Now bring it down, now separate, then bring it
up. I like that.
It's
working really well. 70 acres in Chicago. Well, we are speaking with one of the co-founders and the co-directors of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Festival, Rinaldo Barroso Speck, and I want to welcome him back to the morning show on WBAI. I remember having you here, you and Diarra, last year when the festival was on then, so welcome back, Rinaldo.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having us again.
Absolutely. It is our pleasure. So it is is this the 27th year of the festival or 28? Am I ahead of myself?
23rd.
So I'm ahead of myself. But okay, yes. That's good. We're looking forward to 27 and the 28th year. So, Rinaldo, tell us about the festival in general. What have you been trying to accomplish all these years bringing the festival to folks here in New York City?
Objective of this film festival is to bring to New York City, and I must say other cities, including Chicago, because the festival goes now to Chicago, is that of exposing audiences to films that usually don't make it into the United States. And they don't have to be necessarily foreign films. Some domestic films don't get the opportunity to be exposed to the public because of different reasons. One of them is certain conventions, like, okay, this film is not a film that could be popular or whatever. We don't have theaters, so, I mean, certain films don't make it into a theater. So, I mean, festivals, particularly a festival like ours, is kind of try to complement and present a larger panorama of what is happening with films about the human experience of people of color. That is one of the main objectives of this film festival.
Mm-hmm. And this film that we just heard the clip of, and we were looking at the images here, and I was looking at the images here in studio, 70 Acres in Chicago. Tell me about that.
Well, 70 Acres in Chicago is part of a program that we call Let's Talk About Chicago. As I said earlier, we, for the past 13 years, the festival has been held in Chicago as well. I mean, every June for the past 13 years, we go there and we show films. Out of that work over there. We created some connections, and we were given this film that we didn't know anything about. And then we learned, I knew about the Cabrini Green, I knew about the dislocation of certain neighborhoods, particularly that one. And the film is very explanatory about some of the problems that persist in Chicago. I mean, we hear a lot about the situation in that city, but I think it is not easy to know that things don't happen overnight. And this is one of those films that explain how gradually the community has been dislocated, how gradually structures of regeneration have not been put in place. And then, of course, what follows is chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Not regeneration, degeneration, actually, is what follows as well. Rinaldo Barroso Speck, would you tell us some of the other, or highlight some of the other films that you're excited about this year?
Well, I mean, the selection is very rich and very eclectic. For example, the opening night film is a film set in the Democratic Republic of Congo about the life of Dr. Mukwege, who is a gynecologist that built a clinic to help women who have been subjected to abuses by the guerrilla forces in that area. Dr. Mukwege has been doing this work for a number of years, and his life has been in danger to the point that one of the guards was killed in an attack that his clinic
was subjected
to. So this is the opening night film. We continue a little bit with history, and we have the gala screening is a film about Ethiopia, and the invasion of Ethiopia by the Italians is a piece that goes into the into World War II and the colonial aspirations of Italy. With the Move, the Centerpiece is a film that something is strange because the filmmaker is from Japan, and this Japanese guy met an Afro-Cuban musician who lives in New York City, and he also met this Afro-Cuban musician who lives in Cuba. So he follows both, and then he brings the New Yorker to Cuba back again, and there's a concert at the Institute of Performing Arts in Havana. It is a very interesting film because the film moves between Havana and New York, and we see a number of things, and the music is great. We are planning to have a concert at The Mist, where the film will play, where the band of the of the New Yorker, of the Afro-Cuban guy who lives here in New York.
Wow. Now, can you just tell us a little bit about the, this is really fantastic, just a little bit about the history of the film festival and its goals and mission?
Well, submission is very, very simple. People find us, we throw all their information about the festival, and every year we get films to watch. The fact that we have been able to be a festival that moves out of New York City, we are in Chicago, we are in Washington, D.C., helps us to year-long have a cycle of previewing works that then we play in New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C. Here at Teachers College Columbia University, an institution that I attended, we have a year program, yearly program with films, and we bring people from the community and we discuss about different topics. The objective, as I said, is to expose people to films that usually don't make it. I mean, I must tell you, for example, in the area of documentaries, there was a time when a documentary about people of color couldn't make it because, well, that was not an important subject. That has changed. But even during the time, the Oscars were not very much inclined to pay attention to films, to documentaries about people of color.
That's right.
So We have been able to do that. We have been able, for example, to enrich the landscape of New York City with films coming from places as far as Burkina Faso in Africa, films like the New Zealand film that is in the festival that deals with a subject that people in Africa, in the Caribbean, know very much about, and I'm talking about skin bleaching.
We know
perfectly well that some people want to be lighter, and they use products for that. Well, we have White Lies, which is a film that takes place in the early part of the 20th century in New Zealand. It's during colonial times, and one of the themes in the film is that of skin bleaching. Because, I mean, the Aboriginal population felt inferior to the colonizers, and a way of trying to reach that privileged position, well, they had to change the color of the skin.
Color of the skin had to be white. Well, Rinaldo, as our final moments this morning, let's direct people to the film, to the festival, rather, and how they can get tickets and find out more information, website, and so on. Let's direct people and give them those coordinates, please.
First, the phone number is 212-864-1760. I repeat, 212-864-1760. In some locations, the brochure of the festival is already out there. I mean, one is missed in Harlem. We'll be working with that institution. So, I mean, there are some brochures there. In case people want to know more about it, the website is www.nyadiff.org. I will repeat, www.nyadiff.org.
Well, Rinaldo, when we have more time later in the week, upcoming, and after Thanksgiving, we'll have you, we'll have Diarra on, we'll have some filmmakers on to talk about some of the films that are being presented in this year's, this 23rd edition of the New York African Diaspora International Film Festival. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Rinaldo Barroso Speck, the co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. This is The Morning Show on radio station WBAI. To wrap up the program this morning, we present a serialized reading of incidents in the life of a slave girl, an authentic historical narrative describing the horrors of slavery as experienced by black women. And I congratulate and applaud some of the work from some of the women of WBAI in doing this reading.
When the sun go down, I'll be so glad
when the sun go down.
When the sun go down, I don't
let's
leave it, but
I
wanna lie down.
Dr. Fee owned fine residence in town, several farms and about 50 slaves, besides hiring a number per year. Hiring day on the South takes place on the 1st of January. On the second day, the slaves are expected to go to their new masters. On a farm, they work until the corn and the cotton are laid. They then have two holidays. Some masters give them a good dinner under the trees. This over, they work until Christmas Eve. If no heavy charges are meantime brought against them, they are given four or five holidays, whatever the master or overseer may think proper. Then comes New Year's Eve, and they gather together their little ales and, or more properly speaking, their little nuttings, and wait anxiously for the dawning of day. At that appointed hour, the grounds are thronged with men and women and children, waiting like criminals to hear the doom pronounced. The slave is sure to know who is the most humane
a cruel master within 40 miles of him. It is easy to find out on that day who clothes and feeds his slaves well, for he is surrounded by a crowd begging, "Please, master, hire me this year. I will work very hard, master." If a slave is unwilling to go with his new master, he is whipped or locked up in a jail until he consents to go and promises not to run away during the year. Should he chance the change of mind, thinking to justifiably violate a extorted promise, woe unto him if he is caught. The whip is used till blood flows at his feet, and his stiffened limbs are put in chains to be dragged in the field for days and days. If he lives until next year, perhaps the same man will hire him again, without even giving him the opportunity of going to the hiring ground. After those for hire are disposed of, those for sale are called upon. Oh, you free women, contrast your New Year's Day with that of a poor bondwoman. With you, it is a pleasant season, and the light of day is blessed. Friendly wishes meet you everywhere, and gifts are showered upon you. Even hearts that have been estranged from you soften at this season, and lips that have been silent echo back. I wish you a happy new year. Children bring their little offerings, and raise their rosy lips for a caress. They are your own, and no hand but that of death can take them from you. But to the slave mother, New Year's Day comes laden with particular sorrows. She sits on her cold cabin floor, watching the children, who may have all been torn from her for the next morning, and often does she wish that she and they might die before the day's dawn. She may be an ignorant creature, degraded by the system that has brutalized her from childhood, but she has a mother's instincts and is capable of feeling a mother's agonies. On one of these days, I saw a mother lead 7 children to the auction block. She knew that some of them would be taken from her. But they were all taken from her. The children were sold to a slave trader, and their mother was bought by a man in her own town. Before night, her children were all far away. She begged the trader to tell her where he intended to take them. This he refused to do. How could he? When he knew he would sell them one by one, wherever he could command the highest price. I met that mother in the street, and her wild, haggard face lives to this day in my mind. She wrung her hands in anguish and exclaimed, "Gone! All gone! Why don't God kill me?" I had no words wherewith to comfort her. Instances of this kind are of daily, yea, of hourly occurrence. Slaveholders have a method peculiar to their institution of getting rid of old slaves whose lives have been worn out in their service. I knew an old woman who was for 70 years faithful to her master. She had become almost helpless from hard labor and disease. Her owners moved to Alabama, and the old black woman was left to be sold to anybody who gave $20 for her.
I was caught, and I was brought here from Africa.
I'm a slave from a land so far. I was caught and I was brought here from Africa. Well, it was licked like fire from the white slave master every day. And down on my knees, weeks and weeks before we crossed the seas to reach in the West Indies. Then he made me work.
Yes, I work.
I said I work.
Yes, I work.
Good Lord, no pay. I toil, I toil.
The Calypso King of the World, the Mighty Sparrow. And that wraps up this edition of The Morning Show on WBAI. Pam Brown and Michael G. Haskins. That was Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, an authentic historical narrative describing the horrors of slavery as experienced by black women, read by Barika Tahir Edwards. And I thank all of the women of WBAI thus far that have participated. We'll be carrying this forward, doing as much as we can, trying to find a space for it. Thank you so much, Pam.
Thank you so much, Michael.